Hey, welcome to Keeping Up. It's Clay the Swine Flu Smith, and...
This is Jim Pork Lovin' Fichtel.
It's been quite a week, has it not? We've got a swine flu update for you, and we've also got 10 excellent articles. We really had to whittle them down. So, here's your weekly update, This Week in Journals. So, we'll start with a swine flu update. This is Keeping Up Week 18. You know, what can I say about swine flu except... If you want to know about it, you'd better check the cdc.gov website because this information is changing so rapidly that we can give you information today. There's 109 cases. Make that 110. I think I saw one in the ED.
That's right.
Just a moment ago.
Yeah. And let's see, one death from a child who was actually transferred up to Houston for care. But so definitely keep up on the CDC website. Also check out the World Health Organization website for your minute-to-minute updates on swine flu.
So go to keepingupinem.com, and if you pull up this written summary for week 18, you'll see a link directly to the guidance for clinicians on our website. It's entitled Swine Flu Update. In addition, this is a CME offering for Vanderbilt University. On your screen right now should be the disclosure statement. You need to read that, then you can get your CME credit. Just go to keepingupinem.com and get your credit today. So, without further ado, without any more hamming it up.
Let's go. Let's light this candle. All right. So, first up is Hoffman et al. Coronary computed tomography angiography for early triage of patients with acute chest pain. The ROMICAT trial. ROMICAT stands for Rule Out Myocardial Infarction Using Computer-Assisted Tomography. A very catchy title for another cardiology catchy study. Context and study questions. So really, how useful is coronary CTA in acute chest pain in those patients with low to intermediate acute coronary syndrome risk? The results, this was an observational cohort study of patients presenting with chest pain, had a negative initial troponin, and a non-ischemic ECG. Excluded patients had a history of coronary artery disease. 368 patients were enrolled, 31 people had acute coronary syndrome, meaning 337 did not, and none of these people had events at 6 months. The CTA results, with an average time to test of 16 minutes, 50% had no coronary artery disease, 31% had a plaque, and 19% had stenosis. No one with a completely clean CTA had acute coronary syndrome either during that hospitalization or at six-month follow-up, and this was 183 patients. Now, the limitations to this was they lost 8% of their patients to follow-up. Now, how does this apply to us? Overall, this was a good study supporting coronary CTA, its use in low to intermediate risk patients that are both young, less than 65, and without a history of coronary artery disease. Now, you have to balance overall time benefits with radiation and contrast exposure risk, but if you can get a negative initial troponin, a normal creatinine, and get a CT scan of the heart in 16 minutes, they are out the door in 30 minutes.
You know, so... 50% of the people had no plaque, no stenosis, and it's like rapid troponin, rapid creatinine, rapid CT. See ya.
Yeah.
And they do fine.
Thanks for coming in today.
ROMICAT. Think I've got the next one. Huber Wagner et al. Effective whole body CT during trauma resuscitation on survival. A retrospective multi-center study in The Lancet in April. So whole body CT may find injuries in multiple trauma patients that are not readily apparent on exam. But does this translate into a decrease in mortality? This was a retrospective study that addressed that question. Patients who received a whole body CT had mortality 25% lower than would have been expected based on the trauma injury severity score, TRIS, and had 13% lower mortality than would have been predicted by the risk score, RISC. This is a more stringent set of criteria. So this translates into a number needed to scan of only 17 to prevent one death if you look at the TRIS numbers, and a number needed to scan of 32 if you look at comparison with what risk would have predicted. Now, there's some limitations to this study. I think generalizability is a problem. The Germans were already using a selective whole-body CT approach because they only scanned about a third of the 4,600 patients. So that's going to translate into a higher number needed to scan in the U.S. because we scan anybody that even looks halfway bad. It was also retrospective, so it can't prove causality. And in the discussion section, they really underestimated the amount of radiation needed to do a whole body CT. They state it was about 20 millisieverts, but a recent paper says it's more like about 40 millisieverts. Overall, this study was well done, and they did control for hospital site and trauma expertise at varying facilities. I think the application here is don't scan a mechanism, scan a person. And if you're not at a trauma center, seriously consider limiting your scanning and just transfer them if they have multiple injuries, because a lot of times we have to rescan anyway. We just hope this study doesn't add more fuel to the fire of doing a whole body CT on everybody that stubs their toe. So really, think before you scan. But, you know, we don't need to go whole hog.
Clay, you're really hamming it up today.
I got the next article. This is by Dowling et al. Accuracy of Ottawa Ankle Rules to Exclude Fractures of the Ankle and Midfoot in Children, a Meta-Analysis in Academic Emergency Medicine, in May 2009. So the study question is this. The Ottawa Ankle Rule is sensitive in adults at ruling out fracture of the ankle and midfoot, but what about kids? So this was a meta-analysis and found an N of 3130 patients. That's a lot of people. They ended up with 671 fractures. That's a 21.4% prevalence. And they found the sensitivity was 98.5% for the Ottawa ankle rules in kids in this meta-analysis. It would have resulted in an X-ray reduction of 24.8%. Of note, there weren't many kids less than five. So some limitations would be you really can't use the Ottawa ankle rules according to this meta-analysis in kids less than five. How does this apply? There are advantages of less radiation, decreased throughput time, and decreased cost. But really at our shop, a lot of the kids are getting X-rays in the waiting room. And a lot of times parents come in with an expectation if their kid's got a, you know, ankle injury, they want an X-ray. So I don't think we're going to be embracing this for our kids, but I think it's something to consider. You need to know what's out there.
I agree. It takes longer to tell the parents why you're not getting X-ray than it does to actually get the X-ray, look at it, see it's negative, and then send them home.
I think the radiation exposure from an ankle X-ray is not going to be that important. I think we really need to be focusing on CT and limiting that.
Exactly. All right, next up is Corwin et al. Do emergency physicians use serum D-dimer effectively to determine the need for CT when evaluating patients for pulmonary embolism? This is a review of 5,344 consecutive patients. It was published in the American Journal of Rentgenology, something like that, in May of 2009. Essentially, four radiologists and one ED physician wrote this paper. Context and study question. We commonly work up patients for pulmonary emboli in the ED using risk stratification, D-dimer, ultrasound, CT scan, VQ scan when needed. This group investigated our use, or emergency physicians' use, of D-dimer to necessitate CT scanning. So basically what they wanted to see is if we have a low-risk patient, we get a D-dimer, how often do we still get a CT scan or not? The results, this was a retrospective review of 5,344 patients that was risk stratified by clinical presentation. Overall, the incidence of this group was of PE in this group was 6.1%. That's important to realize because in a lot of European studies, the incidence of PE is almost always 25%, where in all the American studies, the incidence of PE is around 5%. Now, 3,716 patients were thought to be low risk and received D-dimer testing, with 39% being positive, of which a little over half were scanned and the other about 40% were not scanned. Now, the patients who had negative D-dimers, 7% had a CT scan, whereas 93% did not. There was one positive CT scan in the negative D-dimer group, which accounted for 0.6% of those patients with negative D-dimers. The diagnostic algorithm was not followed in over 20% of the patients. Now, the limitations to this study, this was a retrospective study. The risk stratification was not well documented. This is felt to be on clinical presentation, but there's no actually well score. The PERC rule was not utilized. They did not measure the clinical gestalt. So you really don't know how they risk stratified low versus high. There was no follow-up data available. So how many of the 93% low-risk patients with a negative D-dimer and those patients subsequently later went on to have a pulmonary embolus? And also in the low-risk positive D-dimer group, the authors did not go back to determine who had actually contraindications to CT scanning because there was a percentage of people who had positive D-dimers that did not have subsequent CT scanning.
And there's good reasons not to CT scan people. So, I mean, you can't tell what's going on in the bedside. Maybe they had pneumonia.
Right, exactly. Now, the application. So, really, we need to utilize the PERC rule, which is PERC. We have a hyperlink to this article on our website. Wells criteria, and even a good clinical gestalt to risk stratify your patients. Stick with protocols and test properly. There is some people who state for high-risk patients that you should have two negative tests, but there was also another article that says that maybe you don't need two tests, and that was on also on our website. You should give very good specific discharge instructions to those with negative tests. And also, lastly, the D-dimer is non-specific but highly sensitive, which actually makes it kind of the best current screening test for pulmonary emboli, despite the last sentence of this paper.
So the next article is by Frymore et al. Fried pork skins.
I know, Frymore bacon.
Sorry for all the swine references. We've got swine on the brain. So,
we're in hog heaven.
We kind of roasted that last article, didn't we? All right. Anyway, this article is current recommended dosing of vancomycin for children with invasive MRSA is inadequate in pediatric infectious disease, May of 2009. So MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph aureus, largely remains sensitive to vancomycin, but with the minimum inhibitory concentration, or MIC, we see that it is creeping up. So keeping vancomycin levels, the area under the concentration time curve, divided by the MIC at a ratio greater than 400, you don't need to know that number, but just it's for this study, that's essential to prevent treatment failure. It means you got enough vanc around to kill the germs, even if they have a slightly increased minimum inhibitory concentration. As the MIC creeps up, higher doses are needed. Well, a lot of texts recommend a dose of 40 milligrams per kilogram per day. This study estimated vancomycin clearance and calculated the area under the curve. The results were that the 40 milligram per kilogram per day dose was inadequate when MIC was 1 microgram per mil, but the 60 milligram per kilogram per day was more likely to achieve that target area under the curve divided by MIC of greater than 400. So even the 60 milligram per kilogram per day dose, however, was inadequate if the MIC crept up to 2. So the application for your practice, go higher on your vancomycin dose in kids to 60 milligrams per kilogram per day. And that's what we usually start with, is a 20 per kilo per dose Q8-hour schedule. And of course, that's always been the standard if you're wanting CNS dosing. But we probably need to consider that as the MIC creeps in MRSA.
I like it. That's a lot of, that's a lot of initials there.
Kind of creepy.
Now, next up is Gardner et al., internal rotation and taping of the lower extremities for closed pelvic reduction, published in the Journal of Orthopedic Trauma in the May-June edition of 2009. Now, pelvic trauma can be associated with significant hemorrhaging and mortality. Reduction of the pelvic volume and stabilization can be accomplished quickly with circumferential sheeting or commercial binders. These authors present an alternative method to reduce the pelvic volume in patients that may be unable to use sheeting or binders, specifically those with truncal obesity, significant degloving injuries, open fractures, or they already have femoral central lines. Now, the results, this was a technique paper describing a method to internally rotate the legs and tape them together in internal rotation, thus reducing down the pelvic volume. It's a two-person technique. One person internally rotates the leg and the other tapes, either at the thighs or the feet. The tape is placed as strips, not circumferentially, and not over bony prominences. The extremities must be closely approximated to reduce tension on the skin. The limitations to taping is that, really, if you have femoral tibial fractures, it can limit the success of taping because you really have to internally rotate the lower extremities to reduce the pelvic volume. You can, however, place the tape across the splints, but they did not discuss what that may be doing to the lower extremity fractures. Now, the application is that this is a very easy technique that can be applied quickly, both pre-hospital and in the ED, especially if you don't have the commercial binders that are not cheap, or if you're just unable to get a circumferential sheet around the patient. Just tape the legs together.
There's some pretty compelling images in this article worth taking a look at, where you really see that pubic symphysis come together as those legs internally rotate.
These authors actually, several years ago, actually published a paper on circumferential sheeting. And it's good to see that they're actually following up with other methods to reduce that pelvic volume.
All right, next up is Gaeski, early goal-directed hemodynamic optimization combined with therapeutic hypothermia in comatose survivors of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest and resuscitation, April. Now, therapeutic hypothermia works. Several large studies have shown that. And since a post-arrest state is similar to sepsis, Would it be feasible, they wondered, to use early goal-directed hemodynamic optimization in concert with therapeutic hypothermia? Patients after 2005 were enrolled who were post-arrest, comatose with GCS less than 6. And what they found was 18 of 20 patients, they got them enrolled in the study, and they underwent this early goal-directed hemodynamic optimization and therapeutic hypothermia, and they found that over 3/4 of their patients met the goals. They got them to the temperature that they wanted. They chilled them down, just like pork barbecue, to 33 degrees within 6 hours. There was a 50% mortality in the group that got the goal-directed care and hypothermia. What they did is in 2001 to 2005, they took historic controls, and they found that the mortality in that group was 78%. That is 14 out of 18 people died. Now, this was not statistically significant. Important limitations. The protocol was carried out by dedicated study personnel at a single center. This was their sole job, was make sure these goals are being carried out and make sure you chill them down. It also wasn't powered to detect a mortality difference. They really, their goal was to find out, is this feasible to do this goal-directed care and therapeutic hypothermia at the same time? In addition, the mortality difference between the matched controls and the study group could be accounted for by the advances in critical care that we've seen, low tidal volume ventilation, early PCI, and a lot of other things. Something else important to know, GAMAR Industries supported the study, and they made one of the cooling devices that were used in it, but they weren't directly involved in the study design or results reporting, according to the authors. So the application is, use early goal-directed hemodynamic optimization and work on initiating therapeutic hypothermia in your hospital. It works. Shoot for those goals of a mean arterial pressure greater than 80. If they are hypotensive, try to get their CVP above 8. And shoot for then that mixed central venous O2 sat greater than 65%.
Kind of makes sense to me. You know, we cool down post-arrest. Might as well add some early goal-directed optimization as well. I'm just surprised that they couldn't come up with a catchy title for the THEGDHO and really create a nice catchword for that.
I mean, why not call it like the Hegado or something?
Yeah.
That sounds cool.
Much easier to remember. All right, next up is Levitt et al. Identification of early acute lung injury at initial evaluation in acute care setting prior to the onset of respiratory failure, published in Chest, April 2009. Acute lung injury has been well-defined and studied. However, the only successful treatment has been a lung-protective mechanical ventilation protocol. This group attempts to go one step back and define what is early acute lung injury and determine what could be the clinical predictors of progression to acute lung injury. The results of this was a study that they reviewed all the chest x-rays from the emergency department and medicine admissions, and 100 patients subsequently met the inclusion criteria, which were bilateral opacities not due solely to left atrial hypertension. Now, of these 100 patients, a third went on to acute lung injury, and the median time was 22 hours. The only statistically significant predictor was initial oxygen requirement greater than 2 liters per minute. Now, the combined factors of abnormal chest x-ray with these bilateral opacities, absent isolated left heart failure, and initial oxygen requirement greater than 2 liters per minute were 73% sensitive and 76% specific for acute lung injury progression. The numbers aren't great, however, it is the only thing that really fell out from looking at all these 100 patients. Now, the limitations is there are small study numbers with this. Now, application. Now, you should really kind of consider these factors when triaging patients to the floor of the ICU. What's their chest x-ray look like? Is there something else going on besides isolated heart failure? And how much oxygen are they requiring? All this kind of makes sense. Now, what we should stay tuned for, though, is more trials at further defining early acute lung injury and then also developing treatment strategies to prevent progression, since mortality is so high with acute lung injury.
I'm always nervous when I have bilateral infiltrates, and this gives us even more reason. If they have bilateral infiltrates and they need more than 2 liters, you better watch those people very closely. And if you have a step-down unit for your ICU, that'd not be a bad place for
them. Yeah, that's true.
A third of them are going to go into ALI.
Right, and then about a half of those will die.
Yikes.
Yeah. Next up is Mickelson et al. Not Phil Mickelson, but maybe his German spelling brother. I'm going. Game face.
Okay. Need you here.
Okay.
Need you.
Sorry. Okay. Next up is Mikkelsen et al. Serum lactate is associated with mortality and severe sepsis independent of organ failure and shock. Published in Critical Care Medicine, May 2009. So everyone knows that high lactate is bad, but can an initial lactate serve as an independent predictor for mortality in patients with severe sepsis? Now the results in this study, this was a retrospective cohort of patients admitted with severe sepsis with a lactate drawn in essentially at presentation. Intermediate values as defined as between 2 and 4 and high values greater than 4 were compared to low values. And when they found this, it was actually an independent predictor of 28-day mortality. So limitations of this was retrospective. It's unclear how mortality was affected by the underutilization of early goal-directed therapy at this single center. And that was their own phrasing, that they really did not utilize early goal-directed as well as they had hoped to. Now, the application, once again, high lactate levels are bad and should be used in the risk stratification and treatment of these ill patients, and by itself is an independent predictor of mortality. So even before organ dysfunction occurs, a high lactate in itself is bad. Now, that also shows that the intermediate levels, the levels between 2 and 4, are also bad. Utilize lactate. One lactate begets another lactate as well, and check for your lactate clearance.
That's right. I think pig's feet are preserved in lactic acid. Moran et al., decision instrument, and this is also second author, Tyler Barrett.
Oh,
our
very nice.
Own.
Very nice.
Awesome. Decision instrument for the isolation of pneumonia patients with suspected pulmonary tuberculosis admitted through U.S. emergency departments in Annals of Emergency Medicine, the May issue. So which coughing cachectic patient in your waiting room needs isolation? This study outlines some clinical criteria to predict which patient admitted with pneumonia needs respiratory isolation. The results, this was the Emerge ID net, a lot of patients, 5,079 patients were admitted with pneumonia. 244 of these, that's 4.4%, had TB. The authors derived and validated a rule that was 96.4% sensitive and had a negative predictive value of 99.7%. And the rule is this: no TB history or positive TB skin test in the past. They're non-immigrant, not homeless, not recently incarcerated, no recent weight loss, and no apical infiltrate or cavitary lesion on chest x-ray. There are 7 criteria. The limitations, all the sites studied were urban academic medical centers, so that limits generalizability potentially. So the application to your practice, if your patient has none of the above, admit them to a regular room instead of clogging the ED waiting room for that rare and elusive respiratory isolation bed. It can be more rare than some kind of rare animal that's on the endangered list, and I can't think of one right now. Can you?
I like to call it the telemetry bed.
So we thank you so much for listening to this episode of Keeping Up, and I hope it's been beneficial to you. It sure has been a lot of fun. We've been I'm trying to think of another pig joke, Jim.
I'm out of pig jokes.
I'm out, too. I've used pork, ham, roast.
I think we've ribbed the pigs enough.
Anyway, go to our website, www.keepingupinem.com, and you can get your CME credit for this. And again, you need to see the CME disclosure statement that's at the beginning. It's also on our website. And you can also find other fun stuff there, old articles, the blog, and lots of great stuff. And a written summary that has all of these things written out. And it's got hyperlinks directly to Medline so that you can go to the article and read it for yourself. So thanks for listening and tune in next week.
Yep. Everybody have a good week out there.
Let's watch out for that swine flu.